I don't want to configure it. I want to plug it in and it just works. That is more or less the promise of zero-touch provisioning. And of course, there's much more to zero-touch provisioning than zero or plug it in and it pray, especially in the modern era where the number of actions you might want to take when plugging something into the network is reflected by the complexity of your environment, especially the new equipment. But as you'll hear in today's show, it's not just about standing up new. It's also about a different way to upgrade. To catch us up on the art of zero-touch provisioning today is our sponsor, Cisco. We will be considering zero-touch provisioning at scale, IPXE, golden ISOs, and integration with standard tool chains like Chef, Puppet, and Ansible, you know, all those buzzwords of the automation era. Joining us from Cisco are technical marketing engineers Patrick Warashe and Akshak Sharma. Fun fact, Patrick was a Packet Pusher's guest going all the way back to Weekly Show 64 in the dark depths of time in September 2011 when we were talking about the CAT 6500 Soup 2T and thrilling with the excitement of an 80 gigabit per second line card that was coming soon. How time has moved on.
Yeah, lots of waters under the bridge.
Patrick and Akshat, thank you so much. Welcome to the show. Let's start off by level-setting on what zero-touch provisioning is in the world of Cisco. Now, many people know that they can take a device out of the box and lovingly configure it with their artisanal hipster command line interface, but now that we're moving to networking at scale, it's not really a viable strategy. So what is ZTP exactly?
So let me start answering that. ZTP, like the name stands, is zero touch provisioning, hands off the device. So you should be able to go from zero to full configuration just without just unpacking the device, plug it in, and let's go. So in order to do that, we provide several frameworks. There is, of course, the ZTP is completely right now based on the HTTP requests. And from the DHCP server, you get option 67, a boot file name, or it's also IPv6 if you want. And then from there, you download your payload, and that can be a script or a configuration, and then you start executing it.
So it's mainly a script or a configuration, or is it also the boot image? Could I actually load the image as well?
Okay, let's split it in two, actually. So we have IPXE, which is our bootloader installer that also rely on option 67 from DHCP. And that operation is actually performed at the firmware level and allow you to download a new image to basically clean up the device and start from scratch.
Yeah,
and that will take an input and ISO. Basically, we deliver our iOS XR image in the form of a self-extractable, self-bootable ISO, pretty much like any Linux distribution.
Ah, so let's back up a step then. So I don't have to have an iOS image even on this device, but I've got to have something. Something's got to be on that device to get me to the point where it can boot. Pull an IP address, and then based on what it gets back in DHCP option 67, go forth and make that request or act upon the information that comes back in that option. So how much do I actually have to have on the device to have enough to make this request?
Well, actually, you don't need anything because IPXE is just like PXE boot. It's fully backward compatible with PXE boot. It adds several extensions like HTTP boot, HTTPS boot, boot from USB, stuff that you can use with IPXE. Mm-hmm. So it's actually a complete part of the firmware. You don't have to do anything. If there is no valid image on the disk, the firmware will automatically try to boot from the network using IPXE.
Right. So PXE is, of course, what we use for x86 servers. It's well known. It's well understood. And I think importantly, for many people who operate data centers, they've got automation platforms that support PXE, right?
Yeah. Pretty much everybody uses PXE to bring up containers or even bare bones server.
And so this is the key difference here about this new zero touch provisioning process from Cisco, and particularly it's on the iOS XR platform, right? So the idea is that you should be using the same process that your servers are using to boot your routers.
Correct. That's the ID. And PXE boot originally was designed for TFTP. And IPXE extend that to HTTP and USB.
Right. So that's the key summary here is IPXE extends the PXE protocol to load over HTTP and HTTPS, I think, actually, but uses the same sorts of concepts, options in DHCP, and then you load it. And the important part about this is that for many people who are using automated provisioning tools, whether self-developed or commercially developed ones, you really want to use the same way that you're developing your x86 servers as you're doing for your network, because the data center might have many, many, many more servers than you do routers. And so you don't actually want to have a different process for your networking kit. You just want the same process for everything, so your software doesn't change. That's what how it was told to me.
That's absolutely correct. So right. What we want is to align the network device with the compute device.
Mm-hmm. So that's why we would consider IPXE as an idea instead of, you know, for quite a while now, we've seen the white boxes move towards ONIE, the open network environment for loading an operating system, or there's other parts of Cisco are using POAP, power on auto provisioning. But the general consensus here that Cisco is converging on a consistent standard that's coming from what customers are asking for.
Yes, so IPXE is also an open source software. We are looking into, we are considering ONI as well. Mm-hmm. At the time when we design our devices, ONI was still proprietary from Commodus, mm-hmm. and we didn't know what to do with it. Now that it's integrated part of the OCP and open, we may as well move there as it's been adopted widely in the industry. Mm-hmm. So we are looking at that. But so basically, our development predate the open source versions of ONI. And that's why we wanted to have an open source version at the time. And IPXE is fully open. You can download the image directly from IPXE.org.
Now, we mentioned power and auto provisioning before. So it sounds like ONI and IPXE are roughly equivalent, would do same things, give you that bootloader and then the opportunity to go out on the network and find an image, download it, and go from there. Is power on auto provisioning that I think of as associated with the Nexus line, is that also in that hierarchy, or is that kind of further up the chain in the ZTP process?
It's further up the chain. You can perform a system update with POAP, but it's really kicking in when the system boots up. So we, with IPXE, we are right at the BIOS level, and ONI is actually a separate minimalistic busy box based operating systems that has its dedicated partition. So it's very similar in the same way. They both can only capture the management port because they are so minimalistic that the switching fabric cannot be controlled by those operating system. And that's the way they work. Also, ONI is also in some way has what they call the TFTP waterfall, which is very similar into IPXE booting. So, in both in functionality, they are really look-alike. IPXE is more like a bootloader, and ONI is more like a NOS installer. Mm-hmm. It has a little bit more flexibility. Of course, it benefits from several years of development. It's because it's also a fully operating, fully blown operating systems, give you a lot of tools. But IPXE offer very good, interesting tooling. For example, it offers you the capability to use dynamic URL. So what your DHCP can provide you in place of providing you the complete path to your ISO, you can just simply say for percent serial number, percent, etc. inside the URL, the IPXE client will take that, replace with the serial number of the box in doing the wget that he will perform. The HTTP get. Mm. So yep. That's dynamic URL is pretty pretty clever. It also uses the capability to use scripts. They are written in a specific IPXE language. It resembles to PHP mm-hmm. to a certain degree and allow you to cascade or chain load your boot statement. So you can, for example, find one image that corresponds to your serial number. If you don't find that image, you can find another image that corresponds to your product identification, etc. And you can go from top to bottom into the booting instance until you find an image to boot. Or you can drop into a menu where the operator can manually select the image. And that works in V4 and V6.
Now, some people that might be listening to this and going, wow, that's a lot of capability, but I don't have the problem that this solves because they don't stand up that many devices. Now, would So how would we position ZTP and folks that really need to have a zero-touch provisioning infrastructure built out? Are these folks that just stand up lots and lots of new equipment, or does it make sense for smaller environments as well?
The supporting infrastructure is relatively minimal. You don't need much to support this, and it offers you a level of uniformity across your entire network. So you will always have the same version, they'll always have the same patch level, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and maybe another thing that I could add to that is that in terms of the use cases beyond the idea of provisioning multiple devices, is the fact that you want a consistency in how you not only install or subsequently configurations and scripts onto an existing device, but how do you do upgrades going forward? So we've actually seen a lot of our customers look at deploying not only their devices for the first time using IPXE and followed that up with ZTP, but later on, when they need to upgrade images, they do the same thing all over again. So to handle the devices as if they are interacting with either the configuration interaction point or with a model, they basically just reboot their devices and they come up with a centralized state that they've stored somewhere else. So in a way, this streamlines not only their first provisioning exercise, but also their upgrade exercises.
No, that is a really important point that I hadn't thought of, that zero-touch provisioning is good for that initial phase, the stand-up, but then also ongoing. You can use this to do upgrades, and therefore it becomes a central part of your image management as you work on your network infrastructure.
That's right, yeah.
That's right. Not only that, but we also offer, because our image is essentially an ISO, we offer a tool written in Python that is publicly available that allow you to open that ISO and pre-install all the patches, all the packages that you want, even provide a startup configuration, and then repackage it and provide that to IPXE in order to boot your dedicated image to a certain level of patching or package installations that you exactly want. We call that process Golden ISO. It's an ISO that has been customized by the end user to fit his needs, and that he can replicate across his network very easily.
So this is really important, because when I discussed this with somebody else, during the preparation for the show, people were saying, "Oh, but you know what we do when we upgrade is we actually get there's production traffic on here and it's flowing through it, and you can't just reboot it and provision it like it's brand new." And actually, the answer is you usually can. And if you aren't able to, then you probably haven't built your network the right way. Let me explain. If you can't take a device out of service so that you can do an IPXE boot, then your network's not redundant. Rule number one. Rule number two, so you don't want to be doing the upgrade while there's actual traffic going across your device. So you need to work out ways to turn flows off, or just accept the fact that there's a redundant path and it's going to fail over safely to that, which the product should do. But it also means that every time you start the device, it's if you're doing a bare metal provisioning. So you're actually testing your configuration backups, you're configuring your provisioning system and your whole provisioning engine, so that if you ever had to do an emergency recovery, you would actually be coming back into operation faster. So sure, this is what cloud providers do, but this is a practice from big cloud scale companies that you can do in your own network. And really, the upgrade process is based on that we go through today is based on this idea that I'm going to send out arms and legs who's going to type some arcane commands on the Z modem console and upload firmware that's going to be stuck in flat. It literally predates before we had enough memory for these operating systems to run in memory. It's a real transition. I start thinking of upgrading the network as just a provisioning process or reprovisioning.
Greg, and I think I'll add one more point to that. In addition to the notion that people believe you can't really upgrade devices while production traffic is running, there is also this particular notion that the device takes too long. And therefore, either it's a maintenance window that you're going to take care of while you're trying to upgrade these devices, or even if you do have redundancy built in, you lose the redundancy during the upgrade process, and that too for a very long time. Much of these apprehensions come from the fact that, yes, devices do take a long time to boot, do take a long time to finally come up to the state that they need. And one point there, that is something that we've actually been working quite a lot on in terms of reducing both the warm boot time, and I'll sort of classify what these mean, on our devices for the last year or so. So in the upcoming releases towards the end of this year, we'll actually be introducing same devices that boot with iOS XR and are able to hit warm boot times, which basically means booting from disk at around close to 2 minutes. Full boot times, which is booting without any image, close to around four and a half minutes. And that actually is significantly smaller than most of the devices in the service provider vendor space are able to do today.
Yes.
And to a large extent, this helps our customers move towards a redundancy model within the network and be able to take that chance with the idea of actually just rebooting a device and treating that as part of their normal operations.
And I think that's important because the other part about this is that rollback is possible. So if you're frightened of rolling forward because you might not feel that the code is proven or reliable, iPixie actually gives you a better way to roll back. Because if you've got a fast rollback just by reprovisioning the server with the original configuration, you're actually reducing the overall risk of the upgrade.
That's correct. That's correct. It allows you to do that. We provide also, in order to do that, we provide a very rich environment inside the DHCP discovery that the device sent. So we provide a lot of information there. We also provide a lot of that information inside the HTTP header of the initial GET.
It just struck me just how easy it would be to roll back. So if I just had to reprovision back, you know, whether I'm upgrading, provision, I'm rolling back, provision, it's all the same. And a faster process gives me a better recovery and a better rollback and reduces the risk of an outage.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Let's dig deeper into this idea of the golden ISO. So if we've laid the foundations of what iPixie is, it's, you know, the private execution environment that servers have been using for quite some time. I'll put some links into the show notes to the organization that is the custodian of that. It's not one of the normal standards bodies that we're used to in networking. I'm not familiar with this idea of a golden ISO in terms of networking. So how do we talk about this in sense of iOS XR? What's in it? What does it do? And why have it?
So yes, starting with our release 622, we provide a tool called golden ISO build.py. It's in Python. And you need to pre-install a few Python packages in order to use it. You can extract this tool and load it up on your server, Linux server, and then point it to a local repository of RPM that you want to pre-install, point it to your standard Cisco ISO, and point it also to a configuration. And then when that is done, you launch the tool. The tool will load up the ISO, open it up. Since it's an ISO, it's a standard format. You can it has a complete file system organization in it. It will pre-apply all the RPMs. We use RPM format, a la Red Hat, inside our system. So it will pre-apply all the packages inside the system. We'll take the configuration and use it at what we call a configuration candidate that will be applied at first boot. And then repackage the ISO completely. And then you give it a name that actually specify exactly what you have done on it. And then you just deploy it like you would do it. You can do an install upgrade if you want to do it through the CLI, or you can reboot the box saying boot from the network, and iPixie will kick in and pick up that golden ISO. It actually allows, if I step a little bit forward, those operation like package install if you inside a base image are things that you do after the system has been boot up. And it's a serial process, essentially. Yeah. You apply one package, then the next, then the next, then the next, and you do checkup in between. And then finally, you apply your configuration, and then your system is ready. So that's essentially a serial process, and that takes time because you have to verify that all the component of your systems have been updated, and then you move on to the next package. But this avoid this, just make it parallel.
Now, this is not a particularly intelligent process, I'm guessing. What I mean by that is, you know, there's a lot of hype about intent-based networking, for example, where you tell a controller, for lack of a better word, what you want, and then the network gets configured to do that. This is more like a glorified configuration tool that you run knowing what the end result is that you're looking for. And rather than using the command line, you're just using a much more efficient process. Is that a fair way to characterize this?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just another way to boot up. It's a way to boot up a dedicated image, like you can do with Ubuntu. If you, most organizations will not use a barebone Ubuntu that they download. They will probably install packages that they pre-install packages on inside their Ubuntu ISO that they want to use right from the get-go. And then this is actually like it's a customized distribution. Now, getting into what you're saying is more part of the ZTP process that go after.
I think the other part here is what you're saying here, you're talking about loading piece, or element. This would also imply that iOS XR is moving towards being a modular platform.
Correct. So iOS XR is actually completely modular. We provide, I think, 7 packages today. So it's a base ISO, we call the mini ISO, that contain basically the essential routing information based, fabric forwarding information based, the way to handle the switching ASICs, etc. And on top of that, you can pick up whatever package you want to install. If you want a crypto, we refer to it as the K9 package, you have to install it. If you want to have ISIS, you have to install it. You have to install OSPF. You have to install MPLS or MPLS RSVPTE. Those are all modular packages that you can add. So the goal in ISO provide you to get, if you want to use traffic engineering over MPLS, you will have to install the BGP package, the MPLS package, and probably the RSVPTE package as well. And that can be pre-installed. So when you boot up, your system is ready to be configured for RSVPTE.
So there's a key transition here. iOS R is not a monolithic operating system and apps and boot. Everything's not just lumped into one static image. It's now actually a modular image. And so PXE respects that. So if you don't want to run MPLS, as I highly recommend, no, I'm just joking, you can take it out and that code's not there and it's not going to get in your way or cause you problems.
Correct. So if you don't activate the code, it's just wasting space on your disks. But in this case, you can choose to use it. And also, each of those packages have their individual release, so you can upgrade those packages individually.
So the provisioning system that sits at the back end of the Pixie boot is going to have to decide what configuration to give the device. We're not talking about what that system looks like today, but it could be any one of the standard tool chains that you use today.
Yes and no. Actually, iPixie, once it provides a valid path to an ISO, his job is finished. He let the system self-extract the ISO, pre-install the ISO, and then bootstrap into that new operating system. And at the end of that boot process, then the ZTP process starts kicking in. And the ZTP process, much more like the POAP process that you were referring to, is actually using the running environment of the iOS XR, in this case, to perform operation. And that can be download configuration as well. It can be also installed packages. It can also be deploying containers on the device. And it can also install application like Chef or Puppet, for example, that will provide you the tooling for configuration the device using a those configuration tool.
Right. So you can still have that control from the provisioning side. So you still need to be responsible for the Pixie side. You could do it manually, I guess, but more likely you're going to develop some Python and some customization, or you're going to have some sort of platform which is going to do this natively. Is that usually how people would approach it?
Yeah, so you do it. We use option 77 in the DHCP for that. So when the system is in iPixie mode, he send option 77 saying I'm in iPixie mode. When he's in ZTP mode, at the end of the boot process, I'm in EXR-config mode, and now I need something else. I don't need an ISO anymore. I'm already boot up. But what I really need from you is either provide me a script, and that script can be a shell script or can be a Python script. And actually, Akshat wrote the Python part. And it could also be a configuration. So the configuration is just applying a static configuration. It has not much interest. But it's where the interest comes from is essentially when you do dynamic scripting onto the device.
Right. So you can actually use the script to provision the device afterwards.
One of the aspects about the ZTP stage is that it essentially executes whatever it's given to execute. Right. So it's not really looking for an ISO at that stage, because APIXI is already taking care of that. And therefore, at the ZTP front, whether you give it a binary, whether you give it a Bash script or a Python script, etc., it will execute them. The idea, however, behind that is that within the Bash subsystem or with respect to the Python environment, we have libraries that are inbuilt that you can leverage to actually configure everything from scratch. But that doesn't really imply that you couldn't maybe build out a Go binary and push that in and just make that run. That would run too, except that there is no Go library yet. However, Python Bash libraries already exist.
So is there any one of these tools is particularly dominant for the other, or are you really just responding to customers who want all of them?
We're responding to one after the other. It's been sort of a journey from going with Bash scripts for a long time towards customers, particularly in the web space, that prefer Python-based scripts as the primary way in which they operationalize their network. And much of that has to do with integrations with their existing tooling, but also the level of sophistication that they want in terms of model-driven operations with the network, as well as communicating with backend servers during the ZTP process. So they prefer Python to be able to do that over Bash. But to be frank, we've seen customers go in either direction. So whatever their proficiency is, they choose one or the other.
Well, the thing is, it's not a unified system. There's a disaggregation point here, and however your provisioning system looks, you can change it via DHCP. You can actually say, for this device with this MAC address, give it this way. And if that wants to be a Bash script, then you can always change it to a Python script later on. There's no integration here that forces you one way or the other.
Right. And in fact, one of the ways in which we design the Python library for the end user is that we actually mimic the exact Bash library that we already had. And we'll go over the concepts behind the libraries in just a bit. But the idea behind these libraries is that have the option to run a script that can do everything on the node. This includes configuration of XR, but also installation of applications or your own, spin up your own containers, etc., or install your own config management tool client. And while doing all of this, you have to give the capability to the end user to the CLI operations if that's how they want to do it, or all sorts of model-driven operations if that's the way they'd like to do it. And in either case, we've seen that if we're able to look for the user, whether it's in Bash or Python, to be able to do these, then they might just go either way, and it works out.
So what do those hooks look like? Are you actually providing scripts and APIs or Ansible templates for this?
What we've done here is that when you're on the box itself, at that stage, let's root out Ansible for just a bit, because Ansible in particular, being a server-side operation model, would be targeted once the box is up and running and has at least SSH configured. Whereas if we target management tools like Chef or Puppet, for example, the client installation, which has to happen on the box, can still be taken care of during the ZTP stage. But one of the main goals with the hooks that we provided is that think of it from the perspective of a manual user 10 years ago. They would have essentially provisioned the box one by one using the CLI. Now, as much as we'd like to claim that model-driven APIs is the way to go and everybody should be on that bandwagon already, there is a large pool of customers that still does a lot of scripting using CLI for all the vendors. And from that perspective, we had to be able to support both those models. So we couldn't have just gone down the path where we said that, hey, here's a Bash library and here's a Python library that only does netconf or only does gRPC, and this is how you're supposed to configure the boxes going forward. That would have really pushed back the adoption model for ZTP. And so what we did was craft out all of the different hooks that you will need to do CLI operations directly from the Bash, using Bash scripts, or from Python using Python hooks. And in doing so, you can do show commands, you can do all the configuration commands, you can do exec commands that allow you to create RSA keys, etc. And all of that happens in an automated fashion within the Bash script or the Python script. Yeah. So there is quite a bit of juxtaposition between you know, how to concepts with the new ones.
I think one thing to point out here is that iOS XR, or the new releases of iOS, are fully Linux. And then on top of that, there's actually applications. So we talked about the modularity. So, and this includes containers where you can run your own app. So part of the reason that these things work is because you can actually run bash scripts on your iOS XR because there's actually a Linux server or Linux box in there.
That's correct. Actually, we have two containers by default. One that contains the control plane and another one that contains the admin plane. So the control plane is basically where XR itself, the CLI interpreter, resides. And it's where all your control plane protocols are, like BGP, OSPF. And the admin plane is the one that maintains the integrity of the system, communicate with modules, exchange key, et cetera, et cetera. So there's already two containers on the system from the get-go. What we do support is the capability for the end user to deploy his own, what we refer to as third-party container, on the system. Mm-hmm. And that can be, that those containers can be either Docker container or can be Elixir.
Right. I only wanted to highlight that there is a key transition here for people who aren't familiar with iOS XR, in that there's all those tools that we use on Linux servers normally are actually in iOS XR because it's iOS XR. And then you also have containers where apps and stuff load into. And that's partly how you do the modularity that you alluded to in the golden ISOs.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Sorry, I did want to make sure, because I'm not the expert in this topic, because I don't want to pretend that I am. I want to jump back to the golden ISOs. Is it possible to use Python scripts to actually manipulate those ISOs and make them available? Or do you just do that using some sort of tool yourself where you say, delete this file, delete that file? How does that actually look? I just wanted to jump back to that because it just struck me that we didn't really talk about that issue.
So it's the golden ISO build process is actually using a Python script. Okay. And so that is provided inside the ISO. So you just have to copy it somewhere. Then you need, of course, ISOFS and all of the other tools that is required to manipulate ISO image. But what it will do, it will take three arguments. It will take the base ISO that you want to use, the list, the repository where all the packages you want to install are present, and then it will take a configuration. And you know, you don't have to provide a configuration by default. If you want to provision the system through ZTP later on, you can just provide a system with all the packages required. Like you want the manageability package if you want to use netconf, for example, and you want to use netconf over SSH, so you also need to have the K9 package provided. So you need to do these two packages on top of the base ISO. You repackage that. But it's more than that. You can also provide package that contains, for example, what we refer to as SMU, or basically bug fixes inside the package. So you can for example, install OSPF, but you can also decide that I want to install OSPF, but I also want to patch OSPF with this and this and this level of patching. And then you create, if you want, your own customized distributions that contain all the latest OSPF bug fix that are available for that version.
Okay, so that means we can start moving out of lockstep with a full release. So instead of waiting for a full release, I can apply incremental patches like Windows does or Linux does. You can say, I want to do this patch because this is affecting me, but those other patches can wait till the next major cycle because they don't relate to me specifically or not.
Yes, we also support what we call asynchronous update. So if you refer to Windows, yes, you can install Service Pack, but they are always tied to your specific Windows version. If you are on Windows 7, you cannot apply a patch from Windows 10, for example. But in this case, for example, if you are looking for a feature, let's say OSPF, that is available in 6.3.1 and you are running 6.2.2 at this point, as long as the dependencies of that OSPF from 6.3.1 are fulfilled with your version, you can install it.
Right.
So you can actually run OSPF 6.3.1 on your 6.2.2 base image.
Right. So it's not like it's very much a more flexible way of doing managing the apps and the operating system on your router instead of the old way, which was like, you know, here's your lump, eat it, you know, chew it down. It's much more modular. I can change pieces, but even more modular is what you're suggesting. I'm just trying to redact it. You know, it's very difficult to talk about these things on a podcast. So I'm just trying to simplify it. Hopefully I've done some justice.
And we can do that because we use RPM. And RPM contain in the metadata of the RPM, it contained the list of dependencies of that package and everything that is actually stored in a small database inside the system. So when you try to do an RPM install, it will first verify that the required dependencies of that package are fulfilled onto your base system.
And Cisco is doing that work for us. So it's not like I have to do that. It's something that Cisco is producing as part of the IOS XR ecosystem.
Correct.
Which I think is important, right? I'm not expecting, you know, when you have discussions around automation, sometimes it gets a little vague as to who's doing what, and whether I'm expected to write all the code and where the line can be. So I just wanted to draw that together.
Well, yeah, this was possible because of the ISO format and also because of the package format that is based on RPM.
So, Patrick, I want to come back on the question of containers. I think there's a lot more flexibility in there than I might have been able to raise in my initial discussion. The idea of containers is that you've got this operating mini in enclosure where you can run apps and then they can turn them off and turn them back on again. Is there any other features in there that I haven't hit upon when we talked about it earlier?
Yes. So containers run their own root file system, their own rootfs. So we support, for example, an Ubuntu container on inside or iOS XR base operating system. So that's not a problem. So you can choose which file system you want to run, which distribution you want to run. That's not a problem. But also what we do is what we call the XR network namespace. We export inside the container all the interfaces of XR. So they are available. So if you want to tap services on a specific interface using a specific port, you can do that inside the container. So that gives you extremely flexibility if you want to use an application, for example, that you use a specific control process to communicate with another and then push some information down to the iOS XR. You can do that via NetConf. We also support what we call service level API a little bit later. You can do that. So that container itself can be deployed via ZTP.
Which is pretty flexible.
So let me actually add an anecdote to that. We had one of our web customers that had a particular problem with the idea of using the management port in pretty much the same network as their production ports. So they, in all of the devices that they were deploying, they wanted the management port to be in a separate VRF and therefore isolated from the rest of the production traffic. But as they do ZTP, it is probably hard to decipher for some people until they actually do this. But when you start provisioning the device first, you realize that there is no concept of VRFs until you've actually applied a configuration. And therefore, when they had to deal with this particular predicament, they had a management port that went into the VRF state process of ZTP. And therefore, by supporting network namespaces inherently within the kernel and matching them up to the XR VRFs as and when you apply the configuration, we allow you to do context switching between network namespaces as part of the ZTP script themselves. So as soon as you decide to run a VRF, all your subsequent operations can then start operating inside the network namespace. This could be syslogs or download of files or whatever other network operations you can think of. So allowing this sort of sync between the XR networking state and the Linux kernel networking state, it sort of allows us to do ZTP in a pretty powerful fashion.
I think, you know, my initial reaction is there's things I can install into a container, like, you know, really dumb things like iPerf and stuff to do performance testing. But I can actually do much more sophisticated things if I can actually put my own code or my own Python in a container and it's safely isolated. And as you said, if I detect a condition in the network, I can then loop the script around to actually reconfigure the iOS underneath. And that's the sort of thing that you can now start to do as this, you know, this process moves through.
That's right. So we've actually showcased a bunch of different applications earlier that do exactly that. So things like detecting the health of a link using iPerf and then doing a failover using the OSPF Yang model. And these are very typical things that you would do in a more server style environment where you'll use Linux based tools to perform failover operations or change in the configuration state of the server. Mm-hmm. And frankly, we're just borrowing those capabilities and allowing that to be run on top of the ISXR devices.
How far router code has come in the last few years? Sometimes you forget just how much is going on under the surface. And I think that's the lesson I'm taking away from today's session. Patrick, do you have any closing thoughts? Is there anything else you want to highlight to the audience?
I think we cover pretty much everything. So what we refer to as ZTD or Zero Touch deployments, combination of IPC and then ZTP. On top of that, both operating at a different level in the boot process and giving you a large framework where you can really pretty much do everything you want on the system. Everything is possible on the system, including deploying your own container.
Mm-hmm. Closing thoughts, Akshat?
Yeah, I think Patrick covered the gist of it. But the idea is that the combination of ZTP with much of the capabilities in terms of the application hosting infrastructure, as well as the packet IO capabilities that allows applications to run as if they're running on a Linux server, basically allows people to think about network devices in pretty much the same realm as server devices. And therefore, if they know how to provision large-scale server devices or they have certain operational paradigms that are focused on server devices, then they can start applying them to network devices running ISXR now.
Mm. Well, on that thought, I just wonder if, Ethan, how much inspiration did you draw from this discussion today? Has it changed the way you look at things?
Well, what's the thing that kept striking me over and over is that we're beginning to manage, or we are managing, network devices like we manage servers. That whole management platform is coming together, and that's because our network devices now look like servers. For the closer you peer, like, oh, this is actually a server, and it just with some special chips in it for IP forwarding. Yeah. And when you wrap your brain around that, I think there's some network folks that we talk to, Greg, that that seem resistant to that or don't want to get into that model of things, just because. Mm. But yet there are better and more efficient ways to do it. But then just one other comment is just the difficulty of adoption is sometimes tied up in all of the different tools that are out there, and I wish there was more of a straightforward way to make those choices sometimes. But on the other hand, having the flexibility to do what you want within your environment is maybe a good thing too. But there are these moments I have where it's like, can't we just agree on one or maybe two ways to do something rather than supporting all the tool chains and all the different interfaces? But that's the state of the network industry right now, isn't it?
Sometimes you just wonder, all these different standards, do we really need them all? But then again, they all came around for a reason and they happened at a different point in time. I think the thing that I take away from this is that you can just as easily boot a device for the first time as you can an upgrade, and you should regard them as the same thing. And that might mean you have to change the way you think about provisioning systems, because an upgrade is just a provisioning of a system. It needs a config file, it needs a boot image, it needs its apps and its operating system, just like a server does. And we don't handcraft with our artisanal CLI server configs. They literally boot up as VMs and they're remote loaded from ISOs if you're on VMware. But if you're in a cloud type environment, nobody goes in and plugs the server in and then hand cranks the Pixie boot. They just turn it on and boom, away it goes. And networking has to move in the same direction, especially as we get more networking devices, more firewalls, more virtual routers, more virtual, all the virtual appliances we're seeing emerge. ISXR is leading the way here with this breakout, and this IPXE is going to be an interesting transition where we are able to see, I think, some way here, the future of NFV in a way. Oh, well. But that brings us to the end of yet another very nerdy show here at Packet Pushers. Our special thanks to Cisco for sponsoring us today, as without our sponsors, we can't do what we do. Thanks very much to Patrick Warashay and Akshat Sharma for joining us, and for Cisco again for sponsoring us so that we can do this. You can find this and many more other fine free technical podcasts along with our community blog and news site at packetpushers.net/archive. You can follow us on the Twitter as @packetpushers. We're there on LinkedIn. We're on the Facebooks, and you can rate us on Apple Podcasts. That would just help us so very much. And last but not least, remember that too much technology would never be enough.